For the House Committee on Business and Labor for February 8, 2012. We're going to take things a little bit out of order on the agenda. We'll start with the first bill, and then we'll go to the second bill that's up for hearing. And then we will move to the two work sessions at the end of the agenda, and then do the two bills in the middle of the agenda at the end. And that's to ensure that we have all members here to get the bills worked. So we'll start with House Bill 4142, and we'll begin with Co-Chair Kennemer and Co-Speaker Roblin, who is here. And if staff could give us an overview, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, House Bill 4142 requires a contracting agency to apply certain preferences in awarding contracts related to goods, certain goods manufactured for recycling materials. There is an operative date of January 1st, 2013, and an emergency clause in the measure effective upon passage. You have in front of you a Dash 1 amendment, which changes the percentage, the differential from 10% to 5% in regards to the preference. There's no revenue impact on the original measure or the Dash 1. However, there has been a fiscal impact issued for both the original and the Dash 1, which is the same, indeterminate for the Departments of Corrections and Administrative Services.
Gentlemen, colleagues.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here, and for the record, my name is Arnie Roblin. I am a representative from District 9 and one of the co-speakers. This was a bill, when I started looking at it, that hearkened me back to graduating from high school in Port Angeles, Washington in 1966 and trying to figure out how I was going to afford an education at the University of Washington, I hoped eventually, but starting out at a community college. And I had an uncle who worked at a local pulp mill. It was at that time, it was actually before it got bought out by AT&T, it was a Rainier mill that made chemical cellulose. And he said, you ought to come down and get a job at the mill. You can work in the summers and do some stuff and actually provide you the money to make it through college. And it took me most of the first summer to get on, but each summer after that, I worked at that mill and came to appreciate, actually joined the first union that I belonged to, was the AWPPW, Pulp and Paper Makers. It was truly an experience that I believe changed the way I think about things in life. I met some amazing people who worked at that mill, who provided for their families, and a number of them were the parents of people I'd gone to high school with. I felt really good every day I went home, and sometimes it was after double shifts because I would work anything I could to make some money to go to college. But I started to understand the direct relationship between the trees that were growing behind all of our houses and on the Olympic Peninsula and a product, the film that went in Kodak film. It was interesting. Chemical cellulose with just a few different ingredients became filler for ice cream, explosives, filler for explosives, and film for our films. So it was an amazing experience. And when I left there, it wasn't all that long before that mill no longer existed. I have seen that progression of pulp and paper mills leaving both our state and the state of Washington where I first grew up on. And it became apparent to me as these mills have transformed themselves into major recycling industries. We had a mill in Coos Bay on the waterfront that outproduced most other pulp mills in the state, and they had done it for years. It was owned by Menasha for a long time, eventually got bought out, and then disappeared. So I looked around and said, is that continuing to happen? And the answer is yes, it is continuing to happen. We are losing that infrastructure. And yet it is an amazing opportunity for people and jobs that provide family wage jobs. And so as we had done in the past when I was on Ag and Natural Resources, we've looked and said, you know, we have an amazing industry in Oregon. It's called agriculture. And shouldn't we make an opportunity for those agricultural products to be eaten right here in Oregon by our kids in our schools? And the answer that people in our state said was yes. We should give a preference to locally grown produce produced in Oregon in some of the farms that have been here for 150 years, and those our kids should be able to participate in having those great products in our schools. And we have given preferences to do that. And so when I was looking at how can we do something that Oregonians like to do, i.e. recycle, and make sure that those recycled inventory gets used to produce Oregon jobs in a way that doesn't change the scheme of how we compete around the rest of the world, but says we in Oregon, i.e., when we buy recycled products, should in fact say, isn't it important for Oregon workers and Oregon jobs that we, as Oregonians and here in the legislature, support those jobs by giving a preference to when we buy things in the state that we use the recycled products that we have right here and that we use the recycling that we do so well to produce a flow of product to these mills? That's the impetus of this bill. I encourage your support, and I believe it's the right thing to do for Oregon and Oregonians.
Great. For the record, I'm Bill Kenemer, state representative from District 39. It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you, Co-Speaker Roblin, for sponsoring this bill. I guess a couple of different things. First of all, it's interesting to be with the co-speaker and to hear him educate us about this issue and how appropriate. And paper mills helped make that possible, by the way. But a couple of things about this is I had the distinction of having a paper mill in my district, Blue Heron. It had been there for a mere 100 years. I hope that settles in, 100 years. That's a long time. It had been a significant employer and, as the speaker was saying, was a place that had good family wage jobs, that had good benefits, and contributed to quality of life. We saw that mill closed last March, and that was a sad day in Oregon City. It was closed substantially for lack of recycled paper being available, in part, because we ship it out and to China, of all places, where they subsidize it. So it's kind of a double whammy in my view about that. This bill is trying to deal with that shortage of paper, and it uses the state to help subsidize that difference in the cost. I think we need to do what we can to help our mills continue to produce. We need to be working to open our forests. It makes good sense, and I'm glad to be a supporter, and sorry to say that Blue Heron's gone, but we still have some opportunities, and we need to make the very most of those. Thank you very much.
Thank you both. We have questions for our distinguished panel. Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And now, forgive me, but I think it's fair that, you know, you at least get a chance to address a question that's been brought to me. And that is, of course, you know, we all want to do what we can to keep employment in our state, keep our workers working, and get those that aren't back to work. But what if there were other states that were to do the same thing? And I'm posing this question because it brought to me, and I got to thinking about this, and I thought, you know, this it's not that it doesn't make sense. What if other states were to put a preference on paper and that we were to have, you know, a supply run from Oregon to their states, and yet, you know, our employees, I mean, I heard from some pretty large employers that had a couple thousand employees in one case, 1,000 in another. These are people that are working here in Oregon. What if we were to have a limitation, or other states did, on products that they could use? Therefore, we could impact our business by starting somewhat of a precedence here. Are you concerned about that at all, or?
I think we always should look at how we interact with other places. I guess that conversation happened when we were talking about farm goods and producing stuff and getting it into our schools. And I haven't seen that happen in that case. I don't perceive that the amount we're going to be doing will have that kind of an impact. And at the same time, I want all of those mills to keep going. I want the United States to have an infrastructure. If this helps ours and others use some of that, I don't know that it's going to affect the cost. It's going to mean that there will be a product for people to use. I hope that if we can get that to happen and we can have a real conversation with our federal partners about using some other materials that could go into that to make it happen, make it work for everybody. And yet some of those are going to be Oregon-only solutions, and that's part of the problem that we have with the federal government is that we're the only one with ONC lands, and so all of a sudden we're saying we need to use those ONC the way they were supposed to be used. And so we shouldn't do that because other states don't get to do that. That frustrates me as an argument. But it is one we have to watch very carefully. I do not want us to get into those kind of wars. So I understand that. I don't think it'll be a problem. That's just my own personal opinion. And it doesn't seem to have been a problem with our agricultural products. And the people around us do a lot of the same agricultural products.
I might as well take a shot at it, too. You know, I guess what I've learned down here is that there are few solutions that are perfect. And there are flaws, and I guess you have to do a balancing test to decide whether the flaws outweigh the benefits or vice versa, hopefully. I think one of the things that concerns me is that we're losing our manufacturing infrastructure and our timber infrastructure. I think in timber, I mean, timber is on, what, 52% of our lands. It's a God-given natural resource, and I feel like Mike Schaffler up here, but, you know, we ought to cut it and use some of it. And especially in light of the fact that, for example, our timber isn't LEED certified, so we don't have some of the advantages that Canadian and other lumber has. So there are, I think it offers maybe some potential for opportunities that might be there. But it is a tough question. Which child do we love the most? We're making that decision every day down in Ways and Means, because we're all concerned about a whole bunch of different issues, but we have to figure out some kind of a priority, and when we have a reasonable idea, hopefully we work with it. I think people have been working at this bill for a while. It's a reasonable idea. I think good people can see it differently, and I'm not going to sit here and say, this is better than sliced bread, and there are no problems, and that's a fantasy. That would not be a fair and accurate statement. But I think it's an opportunity and one that's needed by many of our workers. And I think it's consistent with the efforts to help green up Oregon and have quality jobs at the same time.
I just want to say one other thing, because he brought it to mind, if I can, and that is, I would hope that each and everyone sitting here and other people would go visit some of these facilities, because when he mentioned the idea of losing our infrastructure, you know, some of the sawmills that have been taken apart in my area and gone off, they're making new sawmill ideas that are much smaller and can do things. Go look at a pulp mill. The first thing that just struck me when I was a young person walking in was, who was the engineer that thought up this?
That's right.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, when you look at, in our particular mill, we had these felts that the material would just pour onto, and then it would just slide off that felt and go into the next part to be rolled. And I'm thinking, wow, who thought about how you take, you know, static electricity and other things to move this product that comes out of these vats that's just this big conglomeration of stuff and dry it and move it and keep it going. And any time that it broke, let me tell you, the young people got to go clean it out. And it was really hot and it was really miserable. So you didn't want that to happen very often. So it is an amazing piece of machinery. And it is an amazing place, and it's infrastructure that once lost, very difficult to put back. So, I'm sorry.
If I could just add to that, too, about infrastructure, I have a little cabin down in Ernie's, in the Speaker's new district. And close there is a little town called Gardner. And it used to have one of the world's largest, perhaps it was the largest, I'm not sure, plywood mills in the world. It was that status, and now you drive by there, there are a couple of warehouses, and it's all cleaned up, and it's something terribly lost, because we have magnificent timber down there that's, well, you can't even go bow hunting in the woods, because it's so overgrown, and we're just waiting for the next fire, frankly.
Come to the Coos County Fair, and you can see the handmade model of that mill that was donated to the mill. It's pretty awesome.
Follow up.
Just briefly. It sounds like your description of pulp mill is a lot like the way the legislature works. So that's good, wonderful.
It's pretty productive. I'm not sure that's a fair analogy.
But I will say, you know, I am signed on to this bill. So for anybody out there listening about where I might be, I'm signed on to the bill. I've signed on to a lot of great concepts that have to do with Oregon labor and how we keep Oregon working and get Oregon back to work. And I'm just trying to work my way through. And your testimony is powerful. And the fact that you two are side by side, I just want to say thanks. You both recognize leaders in your own rights, and appreciate you being here on that. Thank you.
Representative Conger, and then Representative Esquivel.
Oh, jeez. Yeah. What did we do?
Now you have opened the door, so I just a quick comment and then a question. The comment is, if you want to see a real loss of infrastructure, and down to the point yep. where it really is no longer supporting the industry, even if the supply and the demand were there, come east of the Cascades, yeah. where there's about, I think there's a total of 7 mills operating, might be 8.
Maybe.
And it's alarming.
And the timber's diseased.
And there's lots of disease, and there's lots of fires, and everything else. The question I had, actually one other comment. I think I support this in concept because, A, I think it's rationally justifiable. To me, it doesn't seem a lot different than offering a tax incentive to a company to relocate or to preserve jobs. It's an additional expenditure, I guess, of the people's funds, but it's for a good public purpose. And I see the justification behind it. I think it's logical. My concern is some of the unintended consequences. And part of analyzing that is trying to understand what the impact of the bill might be in terms of revenue generated for Oregon companies, in terms of jobs kept or created even, hopefully. Do you have any information about that at all?
I don't, but I think there will be people who can offer that, and I hope you will ask it on both sides of
Absolutely.
This issue. So,
thanks.
Representative Escobar. And then
thank you. Very briefly, before our timber industry becomes something of the past and you have to go to a museum to see what we used to do and the way we used to thrive in this state, I would suggest that all people go see a small log mill, a large double cut, some set works, see a slatbed resaw work, and see the ingenuity that goes on within a sawmill. But more importantly, go see a veneer plant and veneer lathe and see how well they can peel a piece of product out of a block of wood and make it to where it's within 2/1000ths of an inch in thickness and continual consistency throughout the whole ribbon. And more importantly, watch that go through a dryer and then become a piece of plywood on the other end. We're losing a great industry, and I was just thinking, gee, what if we did open the woods? Where in the heck will we get our saw filers and our people to take care of our lathes? They're a dying breed. Mm-hmm. So if you get a chance, go see it, folks, because it's something that you may not see in the next 20 years due to the shutdown of our own only renewable natural resource.
Representative Doherty.
And then very quickly, I think people sometimes forget there was more than Blue Heron. And that's on the West Lynn side, but on the Oregon City side. Yeah. And that was a huge mill. And when that closed down, 10-ish, whatever, years ago, I mean, it was a huge impact on Clackamas County and the people in Oregon City. Because a lot of the people lived in Oregon City worked at that mill. And, you know, you look at that, and I think, I don't know if it's S&P or whatever, the mill that they have in Newburgh. You know, you come off 99, you go through, and you can see the smokestacks of a company that's still going, but it just filed for bankruptcy. So, you know, I think sometimes we go through and say, oh, gee, let's see if I can get a whole ream of paper for $2.99 and not realize that, you know, if I paid maybe $2 more for a ream of paper, it might be part of a mill. So I would hope that that's kind of the mindset of people, because there was... you know, sometimes in the metro area, I mean, we had paper mills. We didn't have the sawmills. But when I worked out of Eugene in the mid-'80s, couldn't go 5 miles any direction without running at a lumber mill out of Eugene. So I think, especially with pulp and paper, let's look at it real closely and encourage us to buy local products, period.
Last but not least, Representative Johnson.
Didn't let the opportunity go.
So I'm sorry.
I just wanted to contribute to this group hug, but I do just not a question, just a comment. But I do think we needs to be clear that it's not simply the lack of recycled or the ability to recycle pulp that has been the demise of so much industry, in particular the pulp and paper industry, but the regulations at multiple levels that we have levied upon industries in this state. And this bill isn't going to fix that. It may help one small targeted area, but we still have a lot of work to do to try to create an environment in this state that allows industry to flourish. So that's all I had, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both again
for
being here.
Yep.
Appreciate you bringing this forward. Why don't we move to the next panel, which will be Frank Goulart, Greg Paulson, and John Lucini. please. We have a number of witnesses and a few other bills to get to, so I'm going to ask if you could please try and keep it to about 2 or 3 minutes each. That would be helpful.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Frank Goulart. I'm a Portland State University master's student studying events in the pulp and paper industry. I've been working on this problem for about a year now. Rather than take up an awful lot of time talking, I've submitted a report of some of the findings and regarding the state of the industry here in Oregon. What I would like to say is please take a look at that report. I do support this bill. I think that it goes a long way to support a local industry here, an industry that we care about a lot in this state, and some of the most valuable jobs we have in manufacturing.
Thank you. Well, we do have that. It'll be entered into the record of the hearing, so thank you for bringing
it. Mr. Chair, if I could observe, perhaps he is walking his talk, if you notice the thickness of this paper. And thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Greg Pallison. I'm the Vice President and Political Director of the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers Union, known as the AWPPW, which we've discussed already this morning. And obviously here in support of HB 4142. Now, as you talked about, this is a jobs bill. And we appreciate Oregon legislators doing things trying to create jobs and keep jobs in Oregon. As many of you know, virtually all the paper mills, not many that are left in Oregon, every one of them have re-equipped and changed their equipment so they can use recovered waste paper in order to make their products, whether it's old corrugated OCC or recovered newspaper or whatever. They've all done that. And, you know, there's a lot of problems and issues with regard to pulp and paper mills and their running. Some of us, regulatory and some isn't. But this is one thing we think that can help on a quick basis and help all the mills. The rising cost of recovered waste paper has been driven largely by U.S. exports to China, which is adding to the closures of our mills. In fact, China now produces more paper products than anybody in the world. And they don't have the raw materials. They don't have the resources for it. The environmental damage and the carbon footprint, we have concerns on along with that. So, local mills provide Oregon solid waste and recycling collection programs with the opportunity to market their fibers closer to home, thus providing those type of Oregon jobs also, and again, reducing their footprint. So, and keep in mind, as you talked about, when paper mills close, they are very capital intensive, large pieces of industrial complex. And generally, they don't restart. And in fact, what's happened to every pulp and paper mill that we represent that is closed, our workers, every one of them has been certified for Trade Act benefits, and largely in part because the equipment gets dismantled and moved overseas and installed mostly in China and comes back online producing the very same products that were made here. And we certainly believe that doesn't make sense. So we have been working with a number of groups real quick, like with some of the employers, and we have spoken with all of the employers in the area. Some of them, I think you'll hear, will support this. They'll speak for them, but some won't. And what I suspect you'll hear is the ones that won't are the multinational corporations, such as Georgia-Pacific or International Paper, who are taking that fiber and they are exporting it overseas and producing products. And we think that they're not as concerned about Oregon jobs. So appreciate the time, and if you have any questions, be happy to try to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Lucini.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. My name is John Lucini. I'm the Vice President of the Pacific Region Operations of SP Recycling Company, and I'm responsible for the procurement of the recovered fiber for the Newburgh newsprint mill, as well as we operate a paper recycling plant in Clackamas, Oregon, that deals with the curbside collected materials pretty much across the state of Oregon. I've been involved with the supply of recycled fiber to that Newburgh mill since the early 70s, when it was Publishers Paper Company and owned by the Los Angeles Times. It's the second largest newsprint mill on the West Coast. We produce the highest percentage of recycled content newsprint in the Pacific Northwest. About 50% of the raw material we use to make our products is recovered paper. Oregon's always been a leader in recycling. In 1983, the Opportunity to Recycle Act provided access to recycling for Oregonians and assured curbside collections in cities throughout the state with populations of more than 4,000 individuals. Newburgh was the first large-scale consumer of old newspapers in Oregon and the Pacific Northwest, and provided a stable market for the recovered paper that supported the implementation of what were some of the first curbside recycling programs in the United States. In 1991, the Oregon Recycling Act strengthened and broadened the recycling requirements, as well as added activities to develop markets for recycled materials. Key to the success of these efforts were the investments in recycling capability at mills like Newburgh and other pulp and paper board mills in the state, providing a viable and consistent market for the materials recovered from these programs that were developed. In 2010, the DEQ reported that 29% of all materials recovered in the state were paper and cardboard, the largest of all the categories that were measured. Of the 270,000 tons of paper recovered, over 30% of this material is consumed at Newburgh on an annual basis in the production of our finished products. The total demand of our mill for recovered fiber in 2012 is expected to be more than 300,000 tons. During the past decade, global competition for recovered fiber has increased dramatically, as has the purchase price, the shipping cost for that material, and the processing cost to deal with this as a raw material source. Commingled collections of residential and commercial recyclables have increased the recovery rates, providing more accessible fiber, but have also resulted in mills having to deal with increased contamination with that incoming recycled material stream. In 2000, SP made an investment of close to $80 million to deal with this new stream of fiber. This process equipment helped us deal with a changing fiber stream and assure that we could make a product that was acceptable to our customers. Even with this state-of-the-art equipment, our mills experienced annual increases in production costs dealing with the recovered fiber that we buy. SP Newsprint plays a major role in the success of Oregon's ongoing recycling efforts to improve the state's recovery rates. We believe we provide the local markets for recovered materials, as well as green jobs for our employees, as well as for our many suppliers and service providers across the state. We fully support this bill. It not only builds on previous market development activities by establishing a preference for Oregon paper products using recycled paper fiber, but with this bill, the state would also be recognizing the important role Oregon paper mills play in the efforts to manage the solid waste generated in this state, as well as the benefits they provide to our state's economy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions for the panel, please? Thank you very much. Oh, sorry. Co-Chair Kenemer.
Let me say something. First of all, Mr. Goulart, I'm sorry I misunderstood this petition was not from you and your report, but I thank you. And I just note here 150,000 jobs lost since 1990 in paper mills. Appreciate the research you've done here. It's helpful. And I think, Mr. Chair, we have another comment, too.
Well, I just wanted to add, I do have written testimony that I want to submit also on there.
Please do, and we'll make sure it gets into the record.
All right, thank you.
Thanks to the three of you for being here. We'll next call Andrea Salinas and Rob Rennie.
Is anyone about this guy? Since he's also a four.
Sure. Why don't we bring up Daniel Bonham also, please? And again, I'm going to ask you to please try and be as brief as possible. There's a lot we have to get done today, and especially if you're submitting testimony in writing, there's no need to read it aloud because we'll have it in the record.
Co-chairs Garrett and Kenemer, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Environmental Council. Oregon Environmental Council supports HB 4142. Oregonians value recycling items that are no longer of use to the household and can find a new life in new products. We must ensure that our state captures the greatest value possible from recycled materials. This means keeping the green jobs associated with processing recyclables into new products in Oregon. To that end, OEC supports HB 4142, which expands the state's existing preference for procurement of recycled products to include a preference for paper manufactured at paper mills located in Oregon. Local paper mills need a boost. The state can support them and the good green jobs they create through this simple public purchasing preference that will send more of the paper recycled by our citizens and businesses to local mills instead of to mills across the ocean. Sadly, paper processing in China is a highly polluting industry. It's not done in a way that's good for the environment or good for the health of workers. The processing of these recycled materials is safe for our air, our water, and our workers. And it means employing Oregonians in the jobs that takes the old and makes it new. OEC urges you to support HB 4142. It will help save good jobs for Oregonians at a time when we need them most. And it will help ensure sustainable processing of recovered paper. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Garrett and Kenmer. My name is Rob Rennie. I live in Newburgh, Oregon. I've been an employee at the SP newsprint paper mill for 35 years. I've enjoyed a wonderful career there. It's a good family wage job. Been able to put both of my kids through college, and they're both degreed, and that's a rare thing this day and age that you can hopefully be able to say that you've been able to help your children in that regard. The biggest concern, I mean, for us is the loss of these family wage jobs in Oregon. We're watching them disappear. Our sister mill was Blue Heron at one time. It was watching that mill shut down was heartbreaking. What I would like to add is that from an employee standpoint, we have met over the last 2 years, 3 years with the company, and tried to find ways to save, cut costs. Unfortunately, what we've come up against is the high cost of fiber. The China export trail has created a very stiff market, and it's been really detrimental to our bottom line. Employees at Newburgh have given up 19% in wages since 2010 in an effort to try to cut costs at that mill. That, I can only say, has been a real tough thing for the employees in that mill. It's a life changer when you start talking about that kind of money. This bill is going to meet with some opposition. I think you're going to hear that today. But I think what I would like to say is that this bill is about Oregon jobs. We're here to try to convince you to support this bill so that the Oregon mills continue to operate. There's probably not a mill in Oregon that wouldn't be positively affected by this. We produce a lot of different products here in this state. So I would again ask you to support this bill, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Bonham?
Thank you very much, Chairman Garrett, Chairman Kennemer, members of the committee. My name is Daniel F. Bonham. I'm the Secretary Treasurer for the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign. Of the Board of Directors, member of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, Local 156. I'm a former carpenter by trade. That kind of work's been awful scarce lately, so now I'm a private investigator.
I'm in the legislature. Duly noted.
I think there's logic there.
We all, and I have before you the testimony, a written testimony, but there's a couple of things that I would like to highlight very briefly. We recognize and accept that international trade is a vital part of our economy. But free trade under the WTO rules has had tremendous impacts on Oregon. And so the question then is, are these impacts favorable or not? Well, it depends on who you talk to. The USTR, Chamber of Commerce will tell you that trade revenues are up, businesses are making greater profits, and that's fine, and that's probably true. But it is also true that tens of thousands of jobs, I believe, I heard a figure of 150
50,000. That's a higher number than I was aware of. Jobs have been lost as a result of the plant closures, which are directly related to these trade. Plus, there's a trickle down economic impacts, and these impacts have been huge because of these free trade agreements, and not in the least because of China currency manipulation, which at one time was as high as 40%. What this means is that a worker in China and a business in China is able to sell their products here in the United States currently at a 28% discount because of their of the way their currency is pegged to our currency. And there's other remedies, but this bill, House Bill 4142, is a very small attempt to get some of that discount back. I'm sorry to hear that it's only 5%. Now, I would think that a 10% against a 28% advantage that that China has over our products would not be unreasonable. There's you might hear in opposition that, well, there's a net gain of jobs. I don't believe that we've ever been able to get the data on that. Certainly their corporate profits are up. But that's a very glib response when you're talking about people who've lost their jobs and have been displaced, and the turmoil that that creates in their families. If we can preserve even a few number, a small number of jobs, then I think we have to ask ourselves, haven't the Oregon workers suffered enough? And if we can help preserve some of these jobs by imposing what amounts to a possibly a 10% advantage in a very small part of the market, then let's do that. So we would strongly urge you to pass HB 4142 to the House floor with a recommendation to vote yes.
Thank you very much, all three of you. Questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Paul Cosgrove and Diane Lancaster, please.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Garrett, Co-Chair Kenmer, Paul Cosgrove representing the American Forest and Paper Association, formerly known as the American Paper Institute. And the only reason I bring that up is I was thinking back as I was preparing for this and noticing John Lucchini was here, that in the 30 years that I represented API and the AFPA, Mr. Lucchini's taught me an awful lot about the paper industry. And what I've learned is it's a very complex industry. And what the reason AFPA opposes this bill is not because it doesn't desire to have recycled paper used in our plants in this state. All of the plants survive only because of recycled paper. They were built at a time when we sawed logs and we had chips, and we don't do much of that anymore. When I first started working, I remember the data was correct then, it may still be correct, that we imported recycled paper from as far away as Chicago and Los Angeles in order to supply those plants. And the industry is very capital intensive, and it's a worldwide industry. But I'd like to highlight some of the problems we see with the bill and why we oppose the state boundary as the basis for purchasing preference. There are a couple of circumstances that come immediately to mind where paper, fiber, and the products made from it flow across lines between Oregon and Washington, for example, every day in both directions in order to make the products that we buy here. There are plants owned by the same company that are literally across the Columbia River from each other. Some part of the process is done on one side, some part of the process is done on another. There are operations in the West of Portland that collect and sort recycled material, ship it to Longview, which, by the way, of course it's across the river, but also employs a lot of Oregonians at that plant, that then moves the finished product back to to Beaverton to be reconstituted into bags and boxes. And those are just some of the examples of the current flow of material. And that's why we, in all cases, oppose boundaries based on state or international lines. The industry has survived because it has had, yes, it's lost a lot of recycled paper to China, but it has tremendous markets in finished products all over the world. We produce more paper in this country than we consume. We depend on international markets to sell those products. And so we're concerned that whenever, in either direction, the lines are made around those markets. And for that reason, we respectfully disagree with the proposal before you. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, we'll first hear from Ms. Lancaster and then go to questions. questions.
Certainly. Co-Chair Garrett and Kenimer, thank you for the opportunity to come before you today. For the record, I am Diane Lancaster. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer at the Department of Administrative Services. I was hesitant to come today because I wanted to always give you good information about the impact and the potential to implement any bill that's before you. I met with 9 agencies yesterday to talk about a couple of bills, and this was one of them. We thought it would be helpful to at least come and tell you that we are not sure about the impact, and you can understand some of the reasons, I think, because of what we've heard so far. Agencies buy paper goods from office supply houses, from janitorial supply houses, and from food service supply houses. I had folks check in, for example, with Office Max, who is one of our top office supply houses, and they told us very sadly that they could not identify any Oregon mills from which they purchase copier paper or printer paper. They do purchase U.S. products, but they are not from Oregon mills because they can't find any. When we touched in on janitorial papers, again, as Mr. Cosgrove pointed out, sometimes paper is put into different products, and the janitorial industry, paper industry, they buy from various sources and different mills around the country and some offshore, and coastwide laboratories told us that they buy different lots and different parcels and packages of things, so it might be somewhat difficult to separate out in the bidding process what would be Oregon milled paper or non-Oregon milled paper. So we were a bit puzzled about how we might effectively implement what you have proposed, but we certainly appreciate where you're going with this. And I think finally there has been some talk here as about the border lines and what those preferences, what these kinds of preferences might do to disadvantage Oregon mills in their seeking of other markets. To let you know, we don't know what that impact could be, and I was very interested to hear what Representative Conger had to say about that. ODOT did say they were a bit concerned about the federal prohibitions around in-state border-contained preferences. But again, we don't have a definite read about that. So with that, I'm certainly available for any questions that you have.
Thank you very much. Questions? All right. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have one final panel on this bill. It is will be Barbara Dudley and Ilana Gwinney, please.
Let's carry this over. We have no meeting on Friday.
Thank you, Co-Chair Garrett. Ann Kenimer. My name is Barbara Dudley. I'm with the Working Families Party, and we're obviously speaking in support of this bill. But I wanted to address a couple of the questions that were raised since we were involved in the crafting of this legislation. In terms of Representative Conger's earliest question about the unfair advantage, I just wanted to remind the committee that the unfair advantage that we are trying to address actually is the one that is created by China's unfair subsidy of its paper industry. And in fact, one of our senators, Senator Wyden, who is U.S. senator, who's co-chair of the Trade Subcommittee in the Senate, has filed a complaint against China for their illegal subsidy of their paper industry. And it's very well documented, and we would be happy to make, or he would, I'm sure, also be happy to make that available to you. So that's the unfair advantage that we're dealing with, that the paper mills here and actually, yes, around the West Coast are dealing with, probably around the country. This does create a preference for purchasing recycled paper, but I want to remind you that there are already statutes that create these similar preferences. The bill the statute that this bill amends creates a preference for recycled products for all procurement that the state does. So they have to figure out how DAS and other procuring agencies have to figure out how to do that. That's already the law. What we're trying to do is expand that to say we're in, when it comes to paper, we want that to be a preference for paper, recycled paper made in the state of Oregon. That's not hard to figure out, whether it's made in the state of Oregon or not. If there is none available of a particular variety that is wanted by one of our purchasing agents or another, then they purchase elsewhere. But it is simply a preference. There is also a bill that you all passed, I believe, virtually unanimously in the House last session, that was HB 3000, that provided for a preference for goods and services made in the state of Oregon. So what we're doing is marrying these two concepts that are already law. It is not anything all that outlandish. And it doesn't in any way block trade. It does simply provide a preference. And I would hazard to say that it is the responsibility of this legislature to look out for Oregon businesses and Oregon jobs. That's what we elect you to do. So yes, you know, it would be nice if we could worry about jobs in all the 50 states of the Union and in all the countries of the world, but you have a very specific responsibility, and that's what we're asking you to look at. The last thing I want to say is that I think it's worth noting the rather remarkable alliance that is supporting this legislation, because many of you have talked about the history of our mills in this state, and you all know as well as I do that it has been a history that has been fraught with tension between environmentalists and pulp and paper workers for many decades. And I am extremely proud of the fact that we have support for this legislation from both sides. We heard from the Oregon Environmental Council. We also have written testimony that's been submitted from the Association of Oregon Recyclers, from the Coalition for a Livable Future, and yes, even from the Sierra Club, supporting this legislation. It's been a long, long, cold winter since we have seen the Sierra Club and the AWPPW on the same side of anything. So I would like to say that this is an extraordinary moment. It's a very Oregonian success story that I think you should be proud of. And I think you should take the opportunity to support this bill and support the people who've been working so hard to make this happen. It's not the full answer. There are many more things that need to be done. We are working on larger solutions, both with the federal government and with something we're calling the Market Retentions Work Group. But this is a piece of the puzzle, and it's something you can do in this session. So thank you very much for your support.
Thank you. It is a remarkable coalition, and it's a credit to you, to the work you did in crafting it. So thank you for doing that. Ilana?
Thank you, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. Very briefly, my name is Ilana Guinney. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO and here specifically today on behalf of our affiliate, the United Steelworkers, who have members who work in many of the mills we've been talking about today. I think that Barbara just gave a great summary of what you've heard. I don't want to take too long, but I do want to add to that that not only have you heard from workers, from environmental representatives, from representatives of various groups, you've also heard from employers with the letter from the Recycling Association and others, and I think that it really is an incredible group that has come together to say that this is a place where we have value-added jobs in Oregon. We don't have enough value-added jobs, especially in our forest products industry anymore, and this is a place where we do, and we want to make sure that we keep those. So thank you very much for your consideration of the bill, and we hope to see you pass it.
Thank you both. Questions? Representative Conger?
Since I was referenced in testimony, I think first of all, I have to clear up a misunderstanding. I don't think the words unfair advantage ever came out of my mouth.
Okay, I'm sorry. That was in my notes.
You don't have to apologize, but I want to be crystal clear. I want every advantage, fair or unfair, that we could obtain for industries and jobs in Oregon. And so if that wasn't clear, I wanted to put that on the record. But I have some questions about this, and it is genuine confusion on my part at this point. A lot of the testimony that we've heard is that the problem in the industry is driven primarily by fiber, not finished products, going to China instead of, and in effect, China being a big, possibly subsidized market for that fiber, and taking that raw material and producing the finished good in China. So I can understand that issue. I don't understand how this bill addresses it.
I could give you a very long answer to that. We were at first thinking of addressing it head on and realized that, in fact, we would have a problem with the Commerce Clause and with other impediments. And so we are addressing that on the federal level. So when we refer to federal legislation, we are talking to Wyden's committee about, Senator Wyden's committee about an export ban in retaliation for the illegal subsidies. So that would be the answer to that. What this does instead is to help shore up the market for Oregon-made paper and create, as the pre-existing legislation did as well, a premium that can be paid that helps to make up some of the difference in the cost of the fiber.
May I follow up?
Follow up.
So it doesn't directly address the problem. I understand that. I also understand I think that was a good explanation of what you're trying to do. I would point out that international trade is not necessarily something that the Oregon legislature is qualified to deal with.
Agreed.
And this is an international trade issue that you're describing, and is properly dealt with exactly the way that you describe Senator Wyden trying to attack the problem. I guess follow-up question goes to if the reaction is to what's going on with China, and what we're dealing with is a subsidy on finished products, how much? It's a two-part question. Do we know how much of the finished products are coming back from China? So we're not addressing the underlying problem. I understand that, and you answered that question. I'm not trying to reopen that. But what we are doing is we're raising the price on the finished product as a way to try to keep the jobs in Oregon. But how much of the finished product is coming back from China, and how many jobs are we going to protect if we can't compete with China? Because implicit in what you're saying is we can't produce paper at the same price that China can because of their subsidies or because of other factors, and I don't care what it is. I'm just saying that's there. So how is this going to save us from it, from that problem?
Well, there are several layers of answer to that. First of all, I don't know that I would call it a subsidy, but perhaps that's as good a word as any, in this legislation that calls for us to pay a little bit more for Oregon paper, which is to offset the fact that China is driving the cost of fiber up. All right, so that, and I don't know your numerical, excuse me for my manners, Rep. Conger, co-chair, et cetera.
entirely okay with
I forget.
Me. In the interest of time,
okay,
we just go right to the answer.
Right. I don't know the numbers in terms of how much finished product does China ship back here. I assume some of the answers to that are in Frank Goulard's study that he did, and if not, we can get you those kinds of numbers. I don't think anyone would know the numbers of how much that OfficeMax sells to DAS comes from China. We could probably figure that out, but it would take a while. But how does this compensate? It assumes two things. One, it assumes that we have an interest, as people were speaking to earlier, of keeping these jobs and these mills here in Oregon functioning. And in order to do that, in the face of what we assume to be unfair competition from China, unfair not only because they're subsidizing the purchasing of fiber, but because they're paying a dollar an hour at best in wages, and because they have no environmental regulations, and so on and so forth. I mean, we all know that litany. So if we're going to compensate for that in the short term, waiting for our federal government to do something about it on a larger scale, we have to be willing to subsidize, if you want to use that word, our own paper industry, at least through government procurement. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's the way I see it. I mean, it's sort of, this is so much an incremental step in the right direction, but we have to take some steps in that direction. I mean, we spend millions of dollars trying to create new, somewhat elusive green jobs in this state. This legislature talks about it every other day. You know, how about this subsidy? How about that tax break? How about this? How about that? We've got some green jobs right here that became green jobs. They weren't all that green to start with necessarily, but they became green jobs, and now we could save them. And there are thousands of them, and they pay decent wages.
And I know I'm going to move on, but I just want to sort of answer the question. Did it answer the question? The answer is no, and it's not because I don't agree with what you said. I do. I'm comfortable calling it a subsidy. If it is, it is, right? If we're paying an additional amount, that's a subsidy. Let's just call it that. Just like we give tax credits and tax breaks to companies to bring jobs to Oregon. It's a decision about how to allocate resources that we've been entrusted with by the taxpayers of this state, and if it's a good policy, then we should do it. And if we're getting a return on our money, we should do it. My question was not that, because I do agree that that's a legitimate discussion to have. And I don't expect you to answer this, because I don't think you have the answer. But the question was more, if we did this, what does it mean for these mills? What does it actually translate to? Because I think it's extraordinarily hard for us. We don't know how much it costs, and we don't know how much it would return. And therefore, it's hard to make a decision about, in an educated decision, or at least it is for me.
All right. Representative Hoyle, and then we should probably wrap this up.
Wrap this up. So very quickly, to build upon what Representative Conner said, as opposed to subsidy, I'd call it a value-added product. Subsidy, value-added product, whatever.
I like value-added product better.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. So if we're our government, if we're purchasing things from Oregon Mills and we're putting Oregonians back to work, who critically need that work and who do that work at a very high quality level, is there any kind of estimate about what kind of taxes they would be paying back, which again goes to fund the government services that purchase that paper?
Nope.
Because I mean, and it is, I think, building on what Representative Conner says, it's theoretical, but it would follow that if we're buying product and putting people back to work that are making family wages, then they are paying taxes, which come back to allowing us to be able to purchase things that are value-added.
Representative Hoyle, thank you for that question. I was asking that same question in a hearing earlier this morning. Every time we talk about saving the state money by paying workers less or by eliminating workers, you have to ask the question of what are we not getting in terms of taxes. And I think right now, you know, if we lose another couple thousand family wage jobs, you know, in this state, as well as there's the multiplier effect of all of the other jobs that supply the mills, you know, and supply the people who work in the mills. We all have had that conversation. What are we losing? I have no way, obviously, of knowing that number, but we've got economists in this state, and we should put them to work figuring that out every time we make these decisions.
Thank you both, and to everyone who spoke to this bill today. It was a very interesting discussion. Co-Chair Cameron and I discussed the possible work session. We're going to carry that over till Monday to give committee some additional time to mull over this issue, since we went pretty fast through this. But thank you again for everybody who was here today.
Thank you.
So we'll close the hearing on House Bill 4142. The work session, possible work session, is carried over till our next meeting, which is Monday. We'll next open a public hearing on House Bill 4144, and we'll begin with Representative Nolan. If she can fight through the crowd, who else should we get up with her? Alana? And Alana Guinea again, since you're also on this bill, I believe. Pardon? Would you like to testify together, or you want to go separately? It's up to you.
Pleasure. Whatever you.
Well, we have two people testifying for the bill, and we have a couple against. So we'll hear from you both, I suppose, and then go to the next panel.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Mary Nolan representing House District 36. House Bill 4144, and I don't know the amendment number. It may be the dash one, but there is an amendment before you. Is it the dash one?
It is the dash one.
And I failed to ask staff to summarize the bill. Maybe we can do that real quick. And the amendment that's in front of us.
But you'll save me a little time, Ms. Van Winkle.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 4144 requires a contracting agency in determining the lowest bid for procurement to make certain additions and deductions that are based upon health and retirement benefits paid to workers that are Oregon residents that are based upon fuel consumption and carbon generation and based on personal income taxes paid by employing workers that are Oregon residents. The dash one amendment strips out the provisions of the measure pertaining to the fuel consumption and carbon generation portions of the formula.
And just to clarify, Mr. Co-Chair, although I think the entire bill has merit in this session, I think it's too complex an issue to take up the second part of it, so I would commend that to your later consideration. I will speak to the bill with the dash one amendment. The premise for this bill is that the state, in making purchases, has two primary objectives. One, in actually procuring supplies, goods, or services at best value. And then the second is, in defining that best value, the state should consider all of its costs, including the direct cost of the procurement, and any costs it would incur for other state policies. And it is that second part that this bill attempts to speak to. And let me be direct. The state has policies for assuring the public health of its citizens, ensuring the basic welfare of its citizens, and we can do that either through direct programs, of which there are many. Oregon Health Plan, Aid for Families with Dependent Children, Oregon Project Independent, Senior Citizen Services, all are ways that the state achieves its objective of providing basic health care and subsistence for its citizens. But if we encourage employers who are bidding on contracts with state agencies to cover some of those costs, or if they voluntarily offer to do that, the premise of this bill is that we are then saving the state in direct dollars for expenditures we don't have to make in a separate part of the budget. And because of that, we should give some credit because it's a savings to the state. It isn't saying you can bid arbitrarily a certain percentage higher if you're a local company. It's that it is directly related to an expenditure the state would otherwise have to make anyway. And that's the important part of it. And I raise that because that also distinguishes it from other bills that we have heard in this legislature and that other states have enacted that give a preference that's arbitrary just in favor of protecting their local employers. This is not arbitrary. It is simply full cost accounting for services that the state would have to pay for elsewhere. And that's particularly why, with the Dash 1 amendment, it really zeroes in on the costs, particularly of health care benefits and pension benefits, that are paid to Oregon residents, because if they're not paid through the employer, the state pays them through the Oregon Health Plan, through Oregon Project Independence, through aid to seniors, through aid to families with dependent children. They're direct offset costs because they're being covered by the employer. I also would like to point out that we have provided testimony via a letter, because he couldn't be here, he's traveling, from the chair of David Evans and Associates, a company whose headquarters is in Portland, established in Portland 30 years ago with 3 employees, now employing 300 employees in Oregon and another 300 employees in 6 other states in the country. They provide engineering, planning, and design services for major projects throughout the state of Oregon and throughout the country, in fact, although most of their other offices are in western states, but they do have offices on the East Coast as well. Examples of projects that you may be familiar with that they're involved with, they're the major design and engineering company behind doing the work on the Columbia River crossing. They do a lot of water system design services. They do a lot of road system design, and they do a lot of wastewater system design. And Mr. Whiteman, who is their CEO, has reviewed this bill and supports it because it both enables them to employ more people in Oregon, but it also allows the state to save money in the mechanism that I mentioned before. I thank you for taking the time to hear this, and I would be delighted to answer questions if you have them.
Thank you much. Ilana.
Thank you, Chair Garrett, members of the committee, Ilana Guinea with the Oregon AFL-CIO. And we really do believe that this is a bill that can help us not only employ people in Oregon, but also cut down on our state's costs in the long run. And that is why we have worked with the representative and are proud to bring it to you today. I want to address a few things that I believe may come up later during the hearing, concerns that others may have. The first of those is the idea of retaliation. Often when we see straight preference bills for our state, we're told that that will cause retaliation in other states and hurt us in the long run. And I want to be very clear that this is not a straight preference. Like Representative Nolan pointed out, this is making sure that Oregon employers who provide jobs in a way that does save our state money in the long run are still able to compete on our state's bids, but it is not a straight across-the-board preference. It is not anything where we are discounting bids from any other states, and I don't believe that it would fall under the retaliation clauses and language in the same way that many of the other bills that have been brought before you in past sessions might have. This is not something that is meant to across-the-board increased costs. It is not an across-the-board percentage cost increase. It is something that, again, is going to allow us to save costs in the long run. I know that there are others who are concerned about the cost issue, and I think we do need to look holistically at where our money is going. This is really about making sure that Oregon employers who are providing these things that save us money can still compete. It does not bypass the low bid process, which I know a few others have raised concerns about. It is still about the lowest bid. It is just looking at the calculation for that low bid. And it also is not an Oregon mandate. It changes the low bid process, but it still says go with the lowest bid, not just with the Oregon company. I think you're going to hear all of those concerns. I want to make sure that we have on the record that I don't believe they are concerns in the way they might be represented, and we hope that you will consider this bill and support it with its amendment.
Thank you very much. Any questions? All right. Thank you both.
Thanks much.
Why don't we bring up three people, Scott Winkles, John Rakowitz, and Diane Lancaster again, please.
Chairs Garrett and Kanemer and members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be up here again in front of you. For the record, I'm Diane Lancaster, the Chief Procurement Officer at the Department of State of Administrative Services. Our main concern about this particular bill, and I have read Dash 1, and so my remarks are going to be focused on the Dash 1 amendment, is that it is a complex type of calculation, and it is frankly something of a struggle for my colleagues and I to get our minds around how this would work efficiently and effectively. Purchasing officers at the state agency level are working fairly quickly to process transactions and don't generally have much exposure or experience in applying formulas
such as this. And I think that has probably been said by the previous testimony. Straight preferences, sure, you know, you calculate the dollar value. But to go with disclosed information that bidders provide, which the bill, you know, says state agencies can ask for that kind of information, and then for the officer to look at that and try to make those calculations and to do that across bids, the agencies that I work with are concerned about how we would do that consistently and do it effectively and do it accurately. So there is that concern. There are actually two calculations. The first one is around low bids for goods and deals with the employee benefit question. The second calculation is actually, as we read it, is when an agency conducts a special procurement for goods or services, and then there would be this determination of low bid. We're not totally sure how many situations that would impact, but we are noting that this bill applies to 279A, ORS 279A, which means it will apply to all ordinary trade goods as well as information technology and construction goods. So I think with that, I'm open for any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you. We'll wait till the end of the panel and go to questions.
Co-Chair Garrett, Co-Chair Kenner, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in opposition to House Bill 4144. I would like to begin my testimony by noting that House Bill 3000 from the last session just took effect on the 1st of January. That was that allowed contracting agencies to offer a permissive preference under 279B. Which is the it's your non-construction projects. We don't know the ramifications of for good, bad, or indifferent, what that legislation will be. Will Oregon businesses see retaliation based on it? We believe that that process should play out, and we should get a book of experience before delving into this area again. In addition, the co-chairs of the General Government Committee and Senator Beyer, chair of Business and Transportation, Senate side, are sponsoring a work group designed to look holistically at the public contracting code and see preferences and encouraging Oregon products, purchase of Oregon products and services is on the list of things that is being considered by that committee. It is a robust committee with multiple public sector, public and private sector participants, as well as representatives of organized labor. League is putting a great deal of effort into that process, and we believe we should have an opportunity to let that play out. Additionally, there are some issues that the League notes we could have could complicate our compliance with this bill. For instance, do we know how many businesses would be willing to disclose the information required in the bill? How many businesses would want to produce that data to a public agency subject to the public records law? And there is no protection for that data. That is a public record. That is competitive information that could place a business at a disadvantage. Some public contracts are very large, might be worth the risk. Most may not be. I guess additionally, there's no present guidance on how a contracting agency is supposed to evaluate the data collected. I will tell you, I also deal with PERS as well as the contracting code, and we spent a great deal of time trying to determine equal to or better than rules dealing with retirement packages. It is not an easy matter for an agency to be able to compare one retirement plan to another when scoring a bid. Additionally, looking at healthcare, how would you rate an HSA versus a VIBA? These are the things a contracting agent would have to look at when scoring one of these bids and determining lowest least cost and in the final award. Additionally, there's nothing in the bill that would insulate an agency from any litigation should information be released, or insulation from an agency if their award gets challenged because somebody believes that we calculated it incorrectly. That's going to result in delays, and delays will cost projects, and that will cost the public financial resources. Additionally, I'd like to run through a couple of examples it was given to me by some of our contracting gurus within the league.
And one would be is, so if you have a public agency and they need to purchase paper, as we talked about, and they're going to Staples, and they issue a, and how do you apply, where do you apply these rules? Is it on the paper, or is it on the value added that the supply company is going to add? It's not clear in the bill how we were supposed to score that bid. Additionally, take a guardrail improvement project, which a guardrail improvement project is something I think most of us would like local governments to do. The purchase of guardrails involves the purchase of guy wires, rails, posts, screws, cement and concrete, any number of goods. If the post is grown, is from a tree grown in Canada but milled in Oregon, where do we score that? If the mill, if the sheet metal comes from abroad but milled in Oregon, how do we score that? These are the challenges that this bill would cause us to would face. And finally, I have been responsible for the league's public contracting code since 2009. In that time, we have seen numerous bills coming forward around this central issue, and we are repeatedly told that, that these are not complicated and that we can implement them, but they're brought forward without consultation with us. Well, we're the agency. We're the ones with the attorneys who have to deal with, implement these laws. We are the ones with the purchasing managers who are going to have to live with it. We are not an unreasonable group of people, and we can sit down and we can reach an accommodation. We are doing so now in the Holvey Wisnett buyer work group. I would just ask that we allow us, we treat with that basic courtesy and respect of simple consultation. We do have, we have issues with the code. The legislature has built an incredibly complex rubric to get to a least cost method of contracting. There are a lot of simple fixes in this process, and with that, I'm going to close my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Winkles. Mr. Rakowitz.
Good afternoon. Co-chairs, members of the committee, John Rakowitz with AGC. I want to start with, I don't think the world of contractors, my members or contractors at large and our industry at large don't get what the intent here. We have as urgent a need as anybody in the state of Oregon to put people back to work. One half, our industry has shrunk by one half since the beginning. We represent 2.5% of the economy as opposed to 5% when this downturn started. So we get the intent. There are, this is a bill that is significant. It redefines the lowest responsible competitive bidding principle that has been in place in Oregon for decades and is the heart of 279C, particularly as it relates to public improvements, the construction contracting law. And it matters at a couple of policy levels. First, this is a long tried and true method for public agencies to get the best bang when they're spending the tax dollar. And I would point to there a lot of newspaper stories about how good a bang they're getting. They're reallocating money because they can do additional projects because the competitive nature of the market today. Contractors are bidding, sometimes even under cost, to get the work. So I think it works. Two, this would also, the basic principle here at work is the competitive nature of this as defined by low bid, responsible bid, really does level the playing field for all contractors. And so we believe in that those two basic principles, and we believe this bill will undermine it. At a practical level, I will try to address a simple thing. If this sort of calculation were inserted into at least 279C, which is what I know something about, it will lead to litigation, particularly in the form of bid protest. We know that because elements of the stimulus package around Buy America did exactly that. We have a clear understanding that it did that. The guardrail example would be one. I got a call from a contractor out of LeGrand had a guardrail project, and everything was on hold because of bolts. Couldn't find the bolts that met the terms of the stimulus package. So this stuff is very complicated in terms of how it plays out. When you insert something new like that, it creates uncertainty, and frankly, bid protests, because the calculations, the consistency, the accuracy, the fairness will be challenged in court by contractors who are bidding. That's what will happen, particularly in this environment. I had a conversation this afternoon after I spoke with the sponsor of this bill with our attorney to make sure we weren't just reacting to this notion of retaliation. And my attorney spent his life in this area of construction law, and he definitely believes that this bill will result in retaliation. And I will tell you, every day I hear another story of another one of my members who are chasing work someplace else. And this bill, we believe, will simply impose a retaliation effect in the half of the states that have those laws or rules in place, and make our contractors in Oregon non-competitive or less competitive in those states. Finally, I just want to say we really understand the intent, but along with Scott, DAS, a whole host of other players, since about 2009, we have attempted to try. There were bills about Buy America, there were bills about Buy Oregon, there were bills about all kinds of different ways, goods, services, labor, etc. And we spent probably 6 months, both industry and a range of public agencies, trying to find a way to do this that would work, that was not so complicated that it didn't create all these unintended consequences I've just outlined. And we simply weren't able to do it. So I would be happy tomorrow, if the committee has any interest or the sponsor, in trying to get a written document from our attorney on the one issue around retaliation, if that's helpful. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I just have to point out, as a lawyer, that litigation creates jobs too, John. Probably not the kind of jobs you're looking for, I would imagine.
Mr. Chairman, this is the business committee, please.
questions for the panel. Representative Boyle.
There's just one thing you said that I found a little confusing. Okay. Thank you so much for coming and testifying. I really appreciate your comments. But at one point, it sounded like you were suggesting that market forces that incent or cause contractors to bid under their cost is that a good thing? Are you saying those kind of market forces?
No.
Because that's not how I see it. I mean, that generally is an unsustainable model. So that was sort of something you mentioned, and I thought maybe you'd want to clarify that.
Co-chairs, Representative Doyle, for the record, my leadership, my boss, no, that is not something that we like to see. I'm pointing out that in this environment, contractors are doing that to simply keep enough cash flow going to keep the doors open. So I use that as an extreme example. We do believe that the taxpayer dollars should buy as much as possible. And so I was pointing that out as an extreme example of how competition does have a benefit to the taxpayer and the public owners who use those dollars to construct. But no, we believe people should have enough profit at least to keep their doors open, for sure. I hope that clarifies.
Well, thank you for clarifying that.
All right. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Three of you. Again, after discussion with the co-chair, this bill is not ready to move, but we would like to open a work session for the purpose of adopting the -1 amendment, which, as we heard, is brought to us by the sponsor of the bill. It removes the language references to fuel consumption and carbon. And the purpose of doing this is just to make clear that as the bill, as we continue our deliberations over whether the bill will move, it would be that version of the bill that would be on the table. So I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 4144. And Mr. Co-Chair, is there a motion, please?
Yes, so Mr. Chair, I move that we approve the addition of Amendment 1 to House Bill 4144.
All right, Co-Chair Kenemer moves the -1 amendment to House Bill 4144. Is there discussion? Is there objection?
Seeing none, the dash one amendment is adopted.
Do I gavel?
And I'll now close the work session on House Bill 4144.
Mr. Chair, there's a quick, we have the ability with the guidelines to be able to schedule the work session for Monday. So that's, yes, just because the hearings, the work session's closed, it can't be still carried over to Monday.
Do I need to say that on the
record? If you want to announce it.
We're reopening the work session to say we're carrying over the work session on House Bill 4144 until Monday.
Yeah, and the Senate's required and the House it is not. So.
Okay.
And by way of explanation also, the committee is not anticipating meeting on Friday.
We were going to go out of order because we had a member who needed to leave, but he has already left. So we may as well stick to the order that's on the agenda since Representative Freeman is here. And so I will open a public hearing on House Bill 4103.
Maybe Teresa, explain it.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
You know, we're all having trouble with this rushing around.
And yes, and yeah. I feel like I'm at the traffic control with all the members and coordinating with them to make sure they're here at the
and
time.
And I'm just, I find
schedule.
Myself all caught up in the anxiety and not thinking it through sometimes.
It's all right, Mr. Chair.
Time, I really have nothing else going on.
Or is that a message to us or to others?
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 4103 creates an income tax credit for capital improvements to business facilities. It caps the maximum tax credit to $50,000 for a capital improvement to a home or $500,000 for a capital improvement to a business facility, and it must equal the certified cost of a capital improvement certified as energy efficient or ADA compliant or 50% of the certified cost for all capital improvements. There is a establishes that the measure's applicability to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2012, and the measure's effective date is the 91st day following adjournment sine die, and there's a subsequent referral on this measure to revenue.
Thank you, Representative Freeman. Please proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Kinnemer and Garrett. I appreciate the time today. For the record, my name is Tim Freeman, and I represent House District 2, also known as God's Country. I do want to thank you and tell you, you are the best looking set of committee that I've testified yet to this session. So it's great to be here in front of you.
How many bills have you had this session?
Is this the first time you've testified?
This might be the first. Needless to say, you are a fine looking group and I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
I realize this is just a public hearing, so I will move rather quickly, recognizing that it's late in the day and I imagine you have many other things to take care of yet today. So I'm going to go through this rather quickly. So number one, I want everybody to realize this is a jobs bill. This concept came out of my first session in 2009 when there was a rather large stimulus package being floated around the building that dealt with government buildings, and this was sort of the counter bill that dealt with public or private type facilities, and the idea would be if we're going to do public buildings and try to stimulate the economy through using tax dollars to build public investments, that we could also do it in private homes. So this stimulates our economy by encouraging local businesses and homeowners to invest in improvements to their property immediately through a tax credit. Under the bill, Oregonians would be able to claim 50% of the cost of their own capital construction projects over a five-year period. I'll catch up with her later. Property owners pursuing green projects or those that promote renewable energy alternatives would qualify for 100% tax credit over a five-year period, as would those making ADA compliant upgrades. The tax credit for property owners would only become effective after the projects are completed. The program would limit the amount of credit to $50,000 for homeowners and $25,000 to $500,000 for business owners. In order to quickly boost job creation, qualified projects must begin before May 30th of 2012. According to Legislative Revenue Office, this bill would have a revenue impact of $228 million over 5 years, yet 100% of the plan's costs would be applied to economic stimulus. None would go to administrative overhead or debt service. These dollars go directly to where the rubber meets the road. Businesses and taxpayers will have an immediate incentive to hire contractors and create jobs to make these projects happen. here are the benefits. According to the most recent analysis from legislative revenue, House Bill 4103 would generate over 6,600 jobs and generates $1.42 billion in personal income growth over the next 5 years. In addition, this proposal would increase property tax values by $253 million over the 5 years and increase local property tax revenues by $4 million over the same period. The plan would boost economic development throughout the state because it gives thousands of Oregonians and Oregon businesses an important incentive to invest in new projects. Many local businesses would benefit and be able to grow upon completion of these projects. For example, a retail shopping center with a new parking lot would attract more customers. A hotel with remodeled rooms would attract more visitors. These projects would increase the value of residential and commercial property throughout the state, which would also increase the property tax revenue for local governments. And finally, the jobs that created through this program mean people and businesses will be earning income and therefore paying more income tax. The amount of credits being claimed is directly related to the number of projects being done. More projects means more job. And I, again, realize that this is just a public hearing. If there is any opportunity to work with anybody on this bill, and we have time to reintroduce it into the Rules Committee and do something this session, all of us claim to be here trying to figure out a way to create jobs. This is just one way that we could do it, and we can change the parameters to whatever effect to make people happy to move it forward. And with that, I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Representative. Are you going to submit your testimony in writing? Because I'd like to see that you cited some statistics that I'd love to have.
I'm happy to give you my notes.
Oh, just notes. Okay.
I was going to do written testimony, but in previous committees, I felt like maybe it didn't get read anyway.
Oh, well, I always read it.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Doherty.
And I know it's late, but practically how this was working, I'll give you an example. Okay, I remodeled my kitchen, $64,000 in remodel.
Right.
In a tax credit situation, I hired a company to do it. In a tax credit situation, of that $64,000, would it be a straight $64,000 tax credit split up over a couple of years?
Depending on your situation, if you were doing ADA or solar or some of those things, it could be the whole amount. But from what you described, my guess it would be half the amount, 50%.
Okay.
And it would be a tax.
So I would get a $30,000 tax credit off my personal income tax?
Over the next 5 years, yes.
So, in other words, actually, you guys would be writing me a check.
Yeah.
You could possibly be writing me a check.
We would all be writing a check. Taxpayers would do that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And the concept comes from the idea that there's a bunch of pent-up capital or access to capital that's not being used. And I'm glad that you did your project and built your home and did it, but there's an awful lot of people that are leery to get those dollars out.
I've got a question, but it was a loan. So does that affect?
Same thing. You had access to capital. Same thing, yes.
Okay.
Representative Matthews.
Would this be where I would state a conflict of interest?
Sure.
I just want to compliment you for bringing it forward. I mean, we've talked about this before. We had a little conversation in 09 and on a broader scale, but I certainly understand what you're trying to do, and that is to create some discretionary income to start filtering through our local area shops and businesses and everybody at home, and not to use the term or coin the phrase Main Street, but I get where you're going, and I appreciate the way you're approaching this, and I'd like to further the conversation with you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and we've taken the word Main Street plan off the bill. That was sort of tied with some other stuff, and we want it to be really something that the whole body can get behind.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, but the key is improvements.
Absolutely.
So people are inspired, actually, that they do have access and will qualify for access to capital to make improvements, to hire the local contractor to get them working and get that money going.
Get them off the dime and go.
Feed their families and get them moving.
So the weird thing is, basically, the state of Oregon would build my kitchen.
Half of it.
Half of my kitchen. Is that how it kind of works out?
Yes.
Only if you cook every Monday. Yeah.
Representative Kenemer.
I appreciate coming to testify today, and I appreciate this idea. You know, one of the problems that we've had here is how do we get the economy moving? And construction industry is one of the biggest pieces of the economy, about 5%. And, you know, a lot of people are sitting on projects and money, especially in this recession. I mean, I've got a little cash because I don't know. I mean, I can go buy a five-year CD at the bank, and I can get 1% interest. I mean, I might as well dig a hole in the backyard. So what are you going to do? But if you could get a tax incentive Then you'd build the project, and then you'd have people going to work immediately. Those people would be paying taxes. You'd get the thing rolling. I think that's how you get it rolling, frankly, but we'll see. And, yeah, and that's my comment.
And thank you. And again, the numbers we put on the paper are just the numbers. If somebody has a better idea, if there's a lower amount of tax credit or different projects that should qualify or different things, I am up for any sort of collaboration and desire to move this bill forward.
And Mr. Representative Freeman, if you would, too, you do have those numbers available, and maybe you could get a memo or something to the committee.
I'll make sure the committee gets an email.
Because I think it's helpful for people to look at LFO put these together.
Absolutely.
So they're not just optimistic.
Representative Escobar had a question.
Yeah, real brief. This fits everything that we've talked about in this building for 2 to 4 years. It puts people back to work. It puts revenue back into our coffers. More importantly, it's your trickle-down that we haven't really discussed. If you have a dollar spent locally, that equates, at least in Southern Oregon, we feel about $4.83 per dollar that is earned in this process. So that's another thing you need to consider, plus the $21.5 million just in personal income alone. That's just statewide.
And clearly it is an investment. I mean, I get that there's a cost to this. I made sure I stated it in my testimony. I'm not trying to hide that from anybody, but some of you may know I serve on the Ways and Means Subcommittee for Human Services. We invest in many areas in many ways, many, many dollars more than this. And this is a way to invest in people working and producing increased property values and developing wealth in our state. So it is an investment. I admit that there's a cost to it. But if we are going to invest in people working, here's a way to do it that does create a local tax base and wealth for the people that live in our communities.
Again, I'm still trying to get the handle on it. Basically, the state of Oregon would be giving me $30,000 on a $60,000 project. I would never have to pay another state tax as long as I live, probably. And so that's where it's kind of weird, because I don't make that much money. So, you know, my state taxes are not tons of money, but if I get a $30,000 tax credit, I'm just trying to get a handle.
5 years.
My hope is that after that 5 years, you'd have the opportunity to pay taxes again.
So I'm not going to get a $30,000 tax credit?
Over 5 years.
So you get $6,000.
So you're going to write me a check?
No. It's a tax credit. It's against any debt you owe, and if you didn't use it up, it would be a carryover.
Yeah. But this doesn't carry over?
Yes.
Not after 5 years.
Not after 5 years.
Not after 5 years.
So it's up to 5 years.
I mean, I'll talk to you a little bit more than this, because I'm going, geez. I'm getting a hard time figuring out the math on this one.
Well, and Representative Doherty, I am excited that you had the capital or access to the capital, and you spent it. So.
Thank you, Representative.
It's all choked up about it.
We have one more person to testify on this bill.
Because of the lateness of the time, I'll just talk to you.
David Roth. Thank you, Representative Freeman.
Thank you.
Drink your water.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is David Roth. I'm a member of Tax Fairness Oregon, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk in some detail about this. But I want to present the case in terms of a personal story that might apply here. This is a hypothetical, and in some respects it's actually true, but I think it will highlight some of the questions the issues that Representative Doherty was pointing to. This bill, let's imagine my circumstances this way. I just heard about this bill last week. That's true. It's really fortunate because my mother-in-law is going to be moving in with my wife and me sometime later this year. We figure that it's going to cost us about $50,000 to improve the place. It's more than a mother-in-law apartment. She's not going to be over the garage. And we figure that about $25,000 of that will go to energy savings. We would be putting in a a small high-tech furnace, and we would be putting in a stairway chairlift, and we'd be putting in a low rise entrance to the house, and another bunch of stuff that would qualify as ADA. So between the 100% credit for the energy improvement and the 100% credit we'd get for the ADA improvements, we'd be getting that $25,000. We'd be spending that $25,000, and it would be free to us. As a matter of fact, in our circumstances, we'd be ready to do this easily because we wouldn't need to get a loan. And that's important to keep in mind, as I'll get to in a couple of minutes. That leaves then the rest of my budget, $25,000, to do other things to improve this place. They wouldn't qualify as ADA, they wouldn't qualify as energy improvements, but they'd be necessary. For them, I wouldn't get 100% credit, I'd be getting 50% credit, the same as the straight kitchen improvement without energy and without ADA. So that's how, as a result, my wife and I would be getting $50,000 worth of improvements at the cost of $12,500. In other words, we'd get three quarters of that project paid for in effect, for free by a tax credit by the taxpayers of Oregon. Now, my thought, as I thought about that, I thought to myself, you know, if this were a real situation, I'd probably be saying to you folks, the next time you're offering free money, please let me know. Now, there's another funny aspect to this proposition. It's the timeline, and this is something that no doubt could be changed, but timing is critical here because actually things are improving rather significantly across much of the economy, as you folks no doubt recognize, and it may be that this incentive would actually be dressing up investments where they don't really wouldn't, instead of being an incentive, it would be more of a windfall than an incentive. Here, the timeline issue I wanted to bring up in particular, though, is this. It says that in order to qualify under current terms of language, we would have to break ground, so to speak, by May 1st or 90 days from the end of the session. It also says that three separate departments of the state, DOR, DOE, and Human Resources Services, would all have to write rules specifically for this bill. I suspect that much of that 90 days would be taken up with bill writing. As a result, if I really needed a loan, if I didn't have the money to pay for it myself up front, and I really needed a loan, I'd have to hold off on that loan until the bill was written in order to see whether or not my project would qualify. The result is I wouldn't even file for a loan until after the rules were written. That would give me very little time, perhaps none, to actually get the loan through, select a contractor, and get the work started. What that means then is that somebody who actually needed this credit in order to do the work, to be able to afford to do the work, really wouldn't be able to do it within the time frame, the window, that this bill currently offers. That leaves then only people like me who could afford to pay for it out of their own resources, who already had a nice line of credit, to go ahead and jump on this project before May 1st, because it really wouldn't matter whether the rules came through the way we would like them or not. Now, it may be that you can resolve that paradox, the timeline problem, in various ways, But I don't know if you want to, and maybe that you can change the credit levels so that they're more reasonable. Keep in mind that the way it's written, anybody who would do an improvement, ADA, energy, or other, that costs less than $5,000, and who might be able to do that out of their own pocket, wouldn't be eligible because the minimum qualifying is $5,000.
That covers it.
I'll be glad to answer
any questions. Thank you, Mr. Rothford, for your testimony. Any questions? Representative Matthews.
Just a point. Thank you for your testimony and your story about your mother-in-law. Mine lives across the street. Yours is going to live with you, so good luck with that. But I do appreciate your story, and you know, I think you've got something there where you're looking at the timeline, also where you're looking at the credit and the limit of 50% or whatever it would be. I think in the end, I think what's happening, and you would hopefully agree, we're charged with trying to find a way to get Oregon back to work.
There's a lot of
great concepts, a lot of good ideas. In terms of construction in particular. A lot of great contractors out there currently building fences and decks and whatever they can because they're not getting hired. So I think what we're trying to do is just find a conversation. And I think, quite honestly, we may not end up with anything like this coming out of this session. I mean, it's short. But ultimately, I think hopefully Oregonians are at least hearing the conversations are being had. And I think it's folks like you coming forward to express your concern and how those are worded that will make a big difference. But in the end, ultimately, we've got to find a way to get people back to work, and I'm glad that the committee had this hearing today to at least have the conversation.
So are we. I also submitted testimony concerning 4076 in revenue. We agree with you 100% about the urgency of helping the recovery. All we're trying to do is to make sure that all those unanticipated consequences that can so often come back to bite you when you start handing out money aren't missed so often. In this particular case, I think there's some pretty important potentials for screw-ups that need careful attention.
Thanks again, Mr. Roth. I think this was a good discussion to have. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4103. We have one more public hearing. Colleagues, I foresee we may need to run just a few minutes past 5 because we have two work sessions to complete, but they won't take long. Yes?
I have another committee that starts at 5.
So do I.
Okay.
So we'll just go through as fast as we can.
Okay. It's the same committee.
Right. Joint Committee of Judiciary and Human Services at 5. I'll just go a little late. All right. So we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4133. And we have three people testifying. We'll bring them all up together, please. Representative Witt, if you could. And Angela Martin and Sybil Hebb, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. State Representative Brad Witt from House District 31 appearing this afternoon in favor of House Bill 4133 and its passage. This is a bill that will provide transparency about the nature and extent of fees associated with the use of state-contracted debit cards that are used to disperse government benefits. The bill requires financial institutions that contract with the state of Oregon for these debit cards to clearly disclose all fees associated with the use of these cards. This information, along with the quarterly reports required in the bill, will enable both card users as well as the issuing state agencies to make informed decisions about the use of these cards. This, in turn, should help to maximize the dollar value of benefits realized from the cards as purchasers make decisions relative to the amount of money that they spend. It's also important to note that 16% of our state's budget is accounted for by these cards, or nearly $7 billion. This is important to all of our constituents who are both card beneficiaries as well as tax-paying benefactors. House Bill 4133 is a small but prudent bill, and I urge the committee's support for it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Garrett and members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here in support also of House Bill 4133, and I very much appreciate your giving this bill time. I know we're running late. I would briefly reflect that Angela Martin had written testimony. She had to leave for an appointment.
And we had received that, and it'll be in the record.
Thank you. From the Law Center's perspective, as you know, we provide services to low-income people. Our clients are the recipients of benefits to whom Representative Witt was referring, and often, unfortunately, those benefits are really the only cushion that people have between meeting their daily expenses, making that rent payment, the ability to put food on the table, and homelessness or hunger. So these are public benefits that are designed for an extremely important public policy purpose, to provide a safety net for really vulnerable Oregonians, and we're supportive of the bill's provisions of transparency and information, both for agencies so that they can understand whether their benefits are being used well, for the public so that they can understand how our state government is working, and for individuals to make sure that they can make their decisions well and avoid fees where possible. The kinds of fees that we're talking about are fees that ATM transaction fees, for example, or fees for making a phone call to a teller, fees for denied transactions. These are fees that happen to us in our daily lives. They're small fees, but in aggregate, they can become quite a problem, especially when a person's only source of income is this public benefit. And just to give you a quick example of sort of the amounts of benefit monies that we're talking about, for example, of three, a household monthly benefit is approximately $250 a month. That's not a lot of money to provide for a household's food. So a $2 ATM charge, if it happens a couple of times and you didn't know it was happening, that can really make a difference in your ability to bring food home for the family. So I'm supportive of the bill for all of those reasons. I wanted to add one other point, which is that as it's currently written, the bill addresses transparency about fees for all of government benefits. It doesn't currently address transparency around fees related to debit cards that are used for the provision of child support benefits and spousal support benefits. And as this moves forward, if there were ever the opportunity to provide an expansion of that language, we think that's an important type of benefit to also be covered. So thank you very much for your support, and I appreciate your
thank
time.
Thank you. And Ms. Martin, we have your written testimony, but if you'd like to give us the high points without reading it, we'd be happy to hear from you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Angela Martin with Economic Fairness Oregon, here testifying in support of House Bill 4133. A couple of highlights. I think we've already heard. I mean, the trend has been over the last decade to move away from paper checks to electronic cards, and in many ways that trend has been positive, both for the states that have realized the savings and for individual consumers or the recipients of these programs who receive their money a little faster, a little more convenient. However, with many things, there are ups and downs, and one of the challenges that we've seen, one of the concerns, has been the costs of using these cards. And the difficulty is that the individual cost of the transaction may be transparent, but how someone uses that card and the impact that it has over a course of a person's month, 2 months, however many, how long they receive this, is not obvious. This came to light as we were working to encourage Treasurer Wheeler to renegotiate Oregon's contract for receiving benefits via the U.S. Bank Relia card. In our efforts to understand how much this contract was worth for U.S. Bank and how much it was worth in terms of the aggregate total impact on recipients, we couldn't get any answers. In my testimony, I include a quote from a national media outlet that attempted to find this information as well. We see that we learned that U.S. Bank secured $350 million in revenue in simply one quarter through their prepaid card division. So this was a full quarter of their revenue came through this prepaid card division, but they refused to say how much of the revenue was comprised of fees from the handling of state unemployment benefits. Understanding this is important to us as we look at future contracts. It's also important in terms of outreach. You know, if we see that individuals are being trapped up with one particular type of transaction, direct service providers could certainly get out there and help folks understand how to be a little more thrifty using their Relia card and drawing down those benefits. So with that, I thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of this bill and close everything.
Thank you. And thank you, Representative Witt, for bringing this forward. I think it's no one would argue that they're entitled to a reasonable profit on their business, but disclosure is always a good idea for my part. Other questions for the panel? Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, we might just barely make it. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4133. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 4092. Mrs. Van Winkle, why don't you remind us where we're at with this?
Mr. Chair, we first heard this bill on the 3rd. What this does is it clarifies the entities that can apply for a special events distillery license and outline the privileges of this. During the public hearing, there was mention of a gut and stuff amendment to clarify the intent and take care of some technical issues that OLCC had after reviewing the original bill. You have in front of you the -2 amendment, minimal fiscal minimum revenue. It maintains the intent of the measure but adds further clarifications, and I believe all the stakeholders are happy with the outcome of the amendments, and they're here in the room.
They're all here nodding their head. I don't think we need to hear from them unless members of the committee have questions, but my understanding is this is a consensus amendment, and I appreciate the OLCC and industry representatives working together with Representative Harker to get this ready to move.
Are you okay? Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. This is Representative Harker's bill?
Yes.
Yeah. It's his constituents' bill.
Oh, okay.
Can we have a recess to discuss this out in the hall, please?
No.
Are you offering anything? This is a distillery bill.
I think there is a reception in the hall, and we may want to visit that. And then maybe in that way, are we in a work session?
We are.
And I would like to offer that we move the -2 amendments to House Bill 4092, dated 2/6/12.
All right. Co-Chair Kenemer moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 4092. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the -2 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4092 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Kenemer moves House Bill 4092 as amended to the House floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none.
Need to
assign a carrier, and I think I see one in the back of the room, Representative Harker. Mm-hmm. Will you carry the bill? Thank you very much. All right, we'll close the work session on House Bill 4092, and I will open a work session on House Bill 4035. Ms. Van Winkle.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is the infamous Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code Bill. During the work session on the 6th, we had in front of us two amendments. Number one, the -1 is the Alternative A bill in regards to the identification types that could be utilized and must be used in a financing statement. The -2 amendment clarifies what types of farm and forestry equipment are required to have a DMV title versus the types that would just need the USCC financing statement. And there is no revenue or fiscal on any of the amendments or the original measure.
Okay, and the second amendment would add the A alternative instead of the B.
-1 is the alternative. Yes, -2 is the DMV.
Just wanted
to keep it succinct as possible.
Did we already adopt the...
No, we concluded the work session by just having discussion. There was no adoption of either amendment because we were also waiting for the paperwork.
But which amendment is the... was the... John Deere.
That is the -2.
It's the -2.
Okay. So just a comment on this briefly, colleagues. We've had a lot of discussion on this bill, more than we expected to. I've discussed it with the co-chair, and it's our preference to move forward with the bill in its original form.
With the dash two
amendments. With the dash two amendments, yes, but not to amend the bill as proposed by the Bankers Association to move to the alternative A. He's not here, but I appreciate what Mr. Cosgrove brought forward. He made some very legitimate arguments, but in our judgment, the Law Commission's bills generally are regarded as technical changes to law. They follow a pretty extensive work group process. It's very inclusive of all stakeholders, and I think the threshold should be pretty high for upsetting the recommendations they bring us, and I haven't been persuaded that we should do that here. So, any further comments on that?
I think the other comment is there is always 2013, which
right.
is not as far away as the previous process. So I think right. it gives an alternative that needs to be there. So
are you ready for a motion?
I'm ready for a motion.
Chair. Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 4035.
Co-Chair Kenmore moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 4035. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Dash two amendments are adopted into the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4035 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Kenmore moves House Bill 4035 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Motion carries. We'll assign a carrier. Who wants this one?
Oh, jeez.
You want to do
you.
It?
I'll do it.
You're the only one that understands it.
I'd be happy to do it.
Yeah. I will carry the bill.
Okay.
We will close the work session on House Bill 4035. Colleagues, thanks for sticking past a few minutes, and we are adjourned.